A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about separation of powers, how different democracies actually implement it, why checks and balances matter so much to the theorists, and who those theorists even are. It's one of those topics where everybody nods along, but if you push, the details get fuzzy fast. So let's fix that. The Vredem Institute's latest report tracked democratic backsliding in at least 18 countries, 7 of which have experienced what they call full autocratization since 2010. So Daniel sent us a prompt about the concept of separation of powers, how different democracies implement it, why checks and balances matter, and who the theorists are that built the intellectual framework. Because people conflate it with checks and balances all the time.
They're not the same thing. Separation of powers is the structural bit, distributing state authority across distinct institutions so no single entity holds all the levers. Checks and balances are the overlapping powers that let each branch push back against the others. Veto, judicial review, impeachment, confirmation hearings.
The version where the bill is just sitting on Capitol Hill feeling lonely.
The reality is messier and more interesting. Separation of powers isn't about keeping branches apart. It's about forcing them to collide in productive ways. The overlap is the point. The UK is the classic example of the second one, but we'll get there. The point for now is that most people picture the US model. 3 branches, strict separation, each one a watchdog, and assume that's what democracy looks like.
Where do we start? With the French aristocrat who got it wrong.
We absolutely start with the French aristocrat who got it wrong. Charles Louis de Secondat, Baron de Montesquieu, published The Spirit of the Laws in 1748. So the thing most people think is the default is actually the minority approach. And some of the most stable democracies on Earth don't separate powers the way the US does at all. He argued that when legislative, executive, and judicial powers are united in the same person or body, there is no liberty. Because the same monarch who makes tyrannical laws can execute them tyrannically.
Whether you separate them institutionally or just make sure they can check each other, the goal is the same.
That's where the theorists come in. To understand why the US model looks the way it does, we have to go back to the thinkers who invented the concept, and they disagreed with each other more than you might think. Montesquieu looked across the channel and said, "Look at Britain, they figured this out. They've divided power so nobody can accumulate enough of it to become a despot."
Except he got Britain wrong.
It's not separation of powers in the modern sense because he's thinking about social classes, not institutional branches. But the core insight is there. Concentrated power is dangerous, so mix it up. The crown appointed judges and could dismiss them. Ministers sat in parliament. The executive was drawn from the legislature. It was a fusion of powers, not a separation, which it kind of did in the limited cases where it was tried. The Roman Republic borrowed heavily from this idea, but Aristotle wasn't proposing a system where the legislative, executive, and judicial functions were separated.
Which is a pretty significant misreading of the thing you're holding up as the model.
It is, but here's the fascinating part. It almost doesn't matter that he got Britain wrong. His normative argument was so powerful that it took on a life of its own. The first thinker who actually distinguished the functions of government was John Locke in the Second Treatise of Government, 1689. He split government into 3 powers, legislative, executive, and federative. The federative power handled foreign affairs, war, peace, treaties. And notably, he did not identify a separate judicial power.
Which seems like a glaring omission from where we sit now.
It does, but in Locke's England, the courts were understood as part of the executive. The king's judges administered the king's law. The idea that judges should be an independent branch wasn't really on the table yet. The judiciary wasn't a separate branch for Locke. It was folded into the executive. So when we credit Montesquieu with inventing the modern separation of powers, the specific innovation was pulling the judiciary out and making it a co-equal branch. Right, and that's exactly the context. The Glorious Revolution had just happened. James II had been deposed. Parliament was asserting itself. Locke was providing the philosophical justification for what had just occurred politically.
That move is arguably the most important institutional innovation in modern democratic theory.
It really is. An independent judiciary that can tell the executive no, that's not a natural arrangement. Throughout most of human history, the guy with the army also got to decide what the law meant. But Locke didn't fully solve it because his federative power was still bundled with the executive, and his judicial function wasn't independent at all. Which brings us to the guy who gets the most credit, Montesquieu.
He gets more credit than Locke.
First, Montesquieu was the one who identified the judicial power as a distinct third branch. That was genuinely new. In The Spirit of the Laws, 1748, he wrote that there is no liberty if the judiciary power be not separated from the legislative and executive. That sentence alone changed constitutional design forever. You have to assume they'll pursue their own interests and then build a machine that channels that self-interest into a stable equilibrium. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. The Spirit of the Laws was published in 1748, and it was cited more than any other source at the U.S. Constitutional Convention, which convened in 1787. The founders had Montesquieu on their desks.
The original defensive pessimism.
And Madison's practical contribution was the idea of overlapping powers. The president can veto legislation, but Congress can override the veto. The president appoints judges, but the Senate confirms them. Montesquieu's framing was more complete. He didn't just list the branches, he explained why each one needed to check the others.
Which brings us to the modern critics who say it's too frustrating, that the American system produces gridlock while parliamentary systems with fused powers can actually govern.
That critique goes back at least to Woodrow Wilson, who wrote Congressional Government in 1885 arguing the American system was inefficient compared to Westminster. But the counter-argument is that gridlock is sometimes the point. Madison is where the theory becomes operational. Federalist number 47 and 51, both from 1788.
That line keeps moving.
Overlap is fine as long as no branch gets everything. It's about multiple centers of power throughout society. Independent media, interest groups, labor unions, civil society organizations, competing political parties, all of these create a dispersed power structure where no single actor can dominate. He was pushing back against critics of the proposed Constitution who were saying, this doesn't separate powers enough. The president has a veto over legislation. The Senate confirms judges. This is all mixed up. Madison's response was basically, yes, and that's the point.
He's saying the Constitution is necessary, but not sufficient.
You can have a beautifully designed separation of powers on paper and still live in an autocracy if there's no independent press, no civil society, no genuine political competition. That's the line. But the fuller passage is even better. Madison says that mere parchment barriers, just writing rules on paper, are not enough to restrain power.
Which is basically the argument Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt made in How Democracies Die in 2018.
He called these auxiliary precautions. The idea is that human nature is flawed. People seek power, so you design the system so that ambition cancels out ambition. There are the hard guardrails, the constitutional text, the laws, the formal institutional checks. And then there are the soft guardrails, the unwritten norms of mutual toleration and institutional forbearance. It's the most clear-eyed political theory ever written by someone who actually had to build a government. Madison wasn't a philosopher in a library. He was trying to get the Constitution ratified.
The norms are the operating system, and the Constitution is the hardware.
And their argument, which has proven distressingly predictive, is that the soft guardrails fail first. Authoritarian-leaning leaders start by testing norms, not laws. They attack the press verbally before they start censoring it. Two that really matter for this conversation. Robert Dahl, who wrote Polyarchy in 1971, and Juan Linz, whose essay The Perils of Presidentialism came out in 1990. And by the time they're breaking laws, the norms that would have mobilized opposition have already been eroded.
You can see this pattern in multiple countries now. Not just Hungary, but Turkey, Venezuela, increasingly in parts of Central and Eastern Europe. The playbook is consistent.
It's a checklist for whether the formal structures are backed by real power. Linz argued that presidential systems are inherently prone to problems that parliamentary systems avoid. His big claim was that presidentialism creates dual democratic legitimacy. Both the president and the legislature can claim to represent the people, and when they disagree, there's no mechanism to resolve it except gridlock or crisis. In a parliamentary system, if the executive loses the confidence of the legislature, you get new elections or a new government. In a presidential system, you get a standoff.
Linz was writing in 1990, so he had a lot of Latin American case studies in mind.
Presidential systems in Latin America had a terrible track record. Coups, breakdowns, authoritarian turns. Linz thought the structure itself was partly to blame. His critique is controversial, but it forces you to ask whether strict separation actually causes more problems than it solves. But Linz's point about dual legitimacy is important for understanding why some systems break and others bend.
That's the theory. Let's talk about how this actually looks in practice. Because when you survey democracies around the world, what's striking is how differently they implement these ideas.
Congress makes laws, but the Senate confirms judges and cabinet officials, and can impeach. The courts interpret laws and can strike them down. Strict formal separation. The president can't sit in Congress, cabinet secretaries can't be members of Congress, the executive is elected independently of the legislature. But then you have all these overlapping powers. No, and that's a perfect example of how practice diverges from text. Judicial review was established by Marbury v. Madison in 1803. Chief Justice John Marshall basically asserted the power and everyone went along with it.
73%. That's not a random distribution.
It's not. And it raises a serious question about whether the judicial check on the executive is functioning as designed or whether the court is effectively becoming a partner in executive aggrandizement. It's both. But it's also the single most important check in the American system. Without judicial review, the courts can't push back against the other branches in any meaningful way.
What's the biggest weakness of the U.S. model? The power to authorize military force has effectively migrated to the executive.
We saw this in 2023 with the government shutdown. The House couldn't pass appropriations, the executive couldn't spend money, and the courts couldn't do anything about it because it was a political dispute, not a legal one. It's voluntarily surrendering its authority. That's not a constitutional failure. That's an incentive problem.
Which is a nice segue to the German model, because they designed their system with exactly that problem in mind.
The founders didn't anticipate political parties becoming this powerful. Madison actually warned against factions in Federalist No. 10, but then the two-party system emerged almost immediately, and his design had to contend with it. They were intensely aware of how democratic institutions can be hollowed out from within, so they built in several distinctive features. The executive, the prime minister and cabinet, are drawn from the legislature. They sit in parliament. They answer questions there. If they lose a vote of confidence, they're out. There's no separate presidential election.
Then there's the Federal Constitutional Court.
The Bundesverfassungsgericht is arguably the most powerful constitutional court in any democracy. Which sounds terrifying to American ears, but the UK has been a stable democracy for centuries. The checks come from different places. The House of Lords was reformed in 1999. Most hereditary peers were removed, and it now functions as a revising chamber that can delay legislation and force the Commons to reconsider.
Which raises an interesting democratic question. If elected representatives decide they want to spend money on climate policy, and an unelected court says no, is that democratic?
It's the counter-majoritarian difficulty in its purest form. In the same building, making rulings and voting on laws. The 2009 reform was a genuine separation of judicial power, and it matters. But the biggest check in the UK system is parliamentary sovereignty. Parliament can do anything, but that also means Parliament can be voted out. The ultimate check is the electorate.
Which is why Lord Hailsham called it an elective dictatorship in 1976.
The argument is that a government with a solid majority in the Commons can pass almost anything with very few institutional barriers. No Supreme Court can strike it down. No president can veto it. The only real check is the next election. Hailsham thought that was dangerously weak.
He wasn't entirely wrong. If a party wins a big majority and decides to rewrite the rules, the UK system doesn't have many internal tripwires. It relies on norms and the restraint of the people in power.
Which brings us to Germany, because the Germans looked at their own history. specifically the Weimar Republic, which collapsed into Nazi rule, and designed a system specifically to prevent that kind of breakdown. The most dramatic example was in 2021, when the court ordered the government to arrest Omar al-Bashir, the former Sudanese president, under an international criminal court warrant. Article 67 of the Basic Law. It says that Parliament can only remove a chancellor if it simultaneously agrees on a successor. You can't just tear down the government and hope something better emerges. You have to have a replacement ready.
That's brilliant. It eliminates the chaos without a plan problem.
It's only been used twice. In 1972, it failed. The opposition tried to replace Willy Brandt and didn't get the votes. In 1982, it succeeded. Helmut Kohl replaced Helmut Schmidt. Both times, the process was orderly. No power vacuum, no crisis. The South African case shows that separation of powers requires not just formal independence, but enforcement capacity.
South Africa has another interesting feature, the Public Protector, which is an independent constitutional office that can investigate executive misconduct. It's a kind of auxiliary check that doesn't fit neatly into the three-branch model.
That's part of what Dahl was getting at with polyarchy. The more centers of power you have, the harder it is for any one actor to capture the whole system. The Federal Constitutional Court. It can strike down laws, ban political parties that threaten the democratic order, and rule on disputes between branches. It's one of the most powerful courts in the world, and it was deliberately designed that way because the post-war Germans didn't trust the legislature to police itself.
Germany has fusion of powers in the parliamentary sense. The executive comes from the legislature, but also strong judicial review and this constructive vote mechanism. It's a hybrid that learned from everyone else's mistakes.
It's been remarkably stable. Since 1949, Germany has had a functioning democracy with peaceful transfers of power. The Basic Law was supposed to be temporary until reunification, and then it worked so well they just kept it. In theory, Parliament checks the executive. In practice, if the government has a solid majority, Parliament is a rubber stamp. South Africa's Constitutional Court is arguably the most powerful court in the world.
Those checks are weakening, particularly in the UK.
The Henry VIII Clause problem is the canary in the coal mine. And in 1996, in the certification of the Constitution case, the court actually sent the text back to Parliament. It said the draft didn't adequately protect certain rights or entrench certain checks, and the Constitutional Assembly had to revise it.
Parliament is voluntarily handing the executive a tool to bypass Parliament.
Which is Madison's nightmare scenario. The branch that's supposed to check the executive is actively empowering the executive to ignore it. They revised the text, the court certified it, and the Constitution came into force in 1997. The whole process was a masterclass in checks and balances working as designed. The court had the power to say no, Parliament had the obligation to fix it, and both institutions respected the rules.
South Africa's court has continued to be assertive. It's ruled against precedents, struck down legislation, ordered the executive to take action.
Including rulings against Jacob Zuma that led to his resignation, and rulings against the current government on corruption and service delivery. The court has become the most trusted institution in the country precisely because it's willing to check the other branches. They rewrote the Constitution. They packed the Constitutional Court with loyalists and then expanded it to add more loyalists. That's the pattern you see across functional democracies. The courts end up being the most important check because they're the least political branch, at least in theory. They don't have to win elections, they just have to be credible. And now, in June 2026, the Parliament passed a law that effectively dissolves the Constitutional Court's power to review legislation.
16 years of incremental erosion, and the formal architecture of checks and balances is now a decorative facade.
In Kesavananda Bharati, 1973, the Indian Supreme Court ruled that Parliament cannot amend the basic structure of the Constitution, even with a supermajority. The media was captured through legal regulatory mechanisms. The system wasn't overthrown. It was operated exactly as designed by people who didn't believe in the design.
Which is Levitsky and Ziblatt's point about norms. The soft guardrails failed long before the hard ones were dismantled.
The Constitution gave Parliament very broad amendment powers, and the court said yes, but there are limits you can't cross. The basic structure includes things like the supremacy of the Constitution, the Republican and Democratic form of government, secularism, separation of powers, and federalism. An electoral commission that's been captured by the ruling party isn't going to ensure free elections. A media landscape that's been consolidated into government-friendly outlets isn't going to expose corruption. And since 1973, the court has used this doctrine to strike down 5 constitutional amendments. That's not striking down ordinary legislation. That's telling Parliament that its amendments to the Constitution itself are invalid.
That's a lot of pushback.
It's controversial every time. Critics say the court is usurping the people's will. Supporters say it's the only thing standing between India and majoritarian authoritarianism. The debate is live and ongoing. Second, how are electoral rules changing? If the rules are being rewritten shortly before elections in ways that advantage the incumbent, that's not technical adjustment, that's power consolidation.
Third, who controls the budget? If the executive can spend without meaningful legislative oversight, or if the legislature's budget office has been defunded or captured, the most fundamental check, the power of the purse, is gone.
Fourth, and this is the hardest to measure but maybe the most important, does the political class still believe in the system? Do losing candidates concede? It really is. After Fidesz won a supermajority in 2010, they used it to rewrite the entire Constitution in 2011. The new Constitution packed the Constitutional Court with loyalists, eliminated or weakened independent institutions, and changed electoral rules to entrench the ruling party. All perfectly legal, all done through the formal amendment process.
They used the tools of democracy to dismantle democracy. The Constitution itself became the weapon. A professional, non-partisan civil service is one of those boring institutional features that nobody thinks about until it's gone.
Fidesz had the supermajority, so they changed everything. He wrote extensively about what he called the spirit of the laws, the cultural, social, and moral conditions that make laws effective. Poland followed a similar trajectory. After the Law and Justice Party, PS, won in 2015, their first target was the Constitutional Tribunal.
The theorists, from Montesquieu to Madison to Dahl to Levitsky and Ziblatt, converge on the uncomfortable conclusion. The system only works if the people operating it believe in it. When that belief evaporates, no constitutional text can save it.
Belief is hard to measure and even harder to rebuild. Hungary's opposition has been trying for 16 years to reverse what Fidesz has done, and they've made essentially no progress, which is an external check that most countries don't have. The EU can sanction member states for rule of law violations, but the process is slow, political, and requires unanimity among other member states. Hungary and Poland protected each other for years by threatening to veto sanctions against the other.
Even the external check failed because it was designed with a veto point that bad actors could exploit.
Which is a design lesson in itself. Any check that requires unanimity among parties with aligned interests isn't really a check. The American system can produce gridlock and executive aggrandizement. The Brennan Center's finding that 73% of Supreme Court rulings on executive authority expanded presidential power suggests the judicial check is not functioning as a constraint. The Westminster system concentrates enormous power in the executive when the government has a majority, and the Henry VIII clause data shows that power is growing. First, can the executive be removed without violence? If the answer is no, if the only way to change leadership is a coup or a revolution, then you don't have functioning checks, full stop. Second, can courts strike down laws? Not just exist on paper, but actually issue rulings that the government complies with?
Is the lesson that institutional design doesn't matter? Because that seems too cynical.
No, institutional design matters enormously. It's just not sufficient by itself. The German Constitutional Court can ban extremist parties because German political culture supports that power. You'd be surprised how many countries fail at least one of those tests. Even countries we think of as established democracies sometimes wobble on the third one. Executive privilege claims that go too far, stonewalling oversight requests.
The thing about these three tests is that they don't depend on the formal structure. A parliamentary system can pass all three. A presidential system can fail all three. The structure matters less than whether the checks have teeth. If separation of powers depends on norms and beliefs, and those norms have been eroded in multiple democracies simultaneously, we're not talking about one country. We're talking about a global trend. What does recovery look like? Is there a playbook for rebuilding democratic norms once they've been broken?
Electoral commissions that aren't run by the ruling party. The specifics vary by country, but the principle is the same. Make it hard for a temporary majority to permanently change the rules in its own favor. Poland had a partial reversal after the 2023 elections, but the new government is finding it extremely difficult to undo the institutional changes the previous government made, partly because the captured courts keep blocking their reforms. Because courts are the only branch whose job is to say, no, you can't do that, even if you won the last election. The executive and the legislature are both accountable to voters, which means they're accountable to majorities.
You're stuck in a loop where the very tools you'd use to fix the problem are controlled by the people who created it.
Which is why some scholars are starting to think about this problem in a different way entirely. The courts are the immune system of democracy. When they're healthy, they catch things early. When they're compromised, the whole body is vulnerable. Some legal scholars are already proposing what they call algorithmic separation of powers, independent AI systems that audit government decisions for bias, for procedural violations, for human rights impacts.
You just need patient judges.
Madison touched on this in Federalist 51, actually. He talked about the need for judges to have peculiar qualifications and the importance of making their appointments independent of the other branches. But he couldn't have anticipated modern party politics and the way judicial appointments would become a central battleground.
Let's address the second misconception we flagged earlier, the idea that checks and balances are inefficient and therefore bad. This comes up all the time. Government should run like a business.
The answer is that checks and balances are designed to prevent catastrophic mistakes, not to optimize speed. A business can afford to move fast and break things because the worst-case scenario is bankruptcy. A government moving fast and breaking things can mean war, oppression, or economic collapse. Different stakes, different design requirements.
Also, businesses aren't actually that efficient. Most large organizations have internal checks, compliance departments, auditors, boards of directors. The idea of the decisive CEO who answers to no one is mostly a myth. The formal architecture matters, but the informal ecosystem of accountability matters more. The inefficiency argument is really an argument for dictatorship with better branding.
It often is, yes. The people who complain about gridlock rarely say, and therefore I want the other party to have unchecked power. They say, and therefore my party should be able to do whatever it wants. The check they want to remove is always the one that's blocking their side.
Which is exactly why Madison wanted ambition to counteract ambition. He knew that people would always find reasons to justify their own power.
The man had a dim view of human nature, and he was right about basically everything.
In 1890, naturalists visiting the Cape Verde Islands reported the discovery of a previously unknown species of naked mole rat, only to declare extinct within the same decade after a volcanic eruption on the island of Fogo blanketed its entire known habitat in ash. No specimens survived in any collection.
The theorists we discussed, Aristotle, Locke, Montesquieu, Madison, Dahl, Linz, none of them anticipated non-human actors in government.
The mayfly of the rodent world.
Which leaves us with the hardest question. What happens when the system breaks, and can it be fixed? The honest answer is that we have more examples of democratic erosion than democratic restoration. But that doesn't mean restoration is impossible. It means it requires something that can't be legislated. A political movement willing to use power to rebuild constraints on power. That's a paradox, but it might be the only way forward.
If you found this episode valuable, rate and review the show. It helps other curious minds find us. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep,
The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.